Chapter 19.
Did you think we were stupid?
The voice belonged to Officer Kim, and the question arrived with a brutal slap across Ryder's face. A kick to his gut brought a flash of light behind his eyes. It felt like his guts had burst, that the toe of Officer Kim's boot had gone all the way through his stomach to his backbone. He couldn't breathe.
I warned you, Kim said again. I warned you what would happen if you did stupid shit like this.
A kick landed at the base of Ryder's spine, right at his tailbone, and that was the worst pain yet. A hand wrapped around the front of his throat, just under his jaw, and lifted him off the ground. He'd brought his legs up to protect himself, but now he had to lower them and open himself up to more body blows to keep himself from getting hanged by a hand.
This is what I do for a living, Rai-Rai. I hurt people, and I like it. Did you think I was lying to you?
He threw Ryder to the ground. The boy curled up again and covered his head, hoping to... The next kick nailed his thigh and triggered a cramp, a Charlie horse.
Please,
he tried to say, but he couldn't produce much sound.
Get on your feet, Officer Kim commanded. Don't think for a second that I can't break every bone in your body while you're lying there. Get on your goddamn feet and get back to the cabin.
Ryder didn't know how long this abuse had been going on. It felt like just a few minutes, but it could have been an hour. He didn't know if he'd lost consciousness or not. Was he going to have permanent brain damage like all those football players in the news? His hair pulled tight against his scalp, and he was being pulled up again.
I said, get on your feet! Get back to the cabin!
The words startled Ryder, gave him a flash of hope. Maybe he wasn't going to die here in the woods after all.
Where's Jeff?
He tried to spit a wad of blood, but ended up drooling it instead.
You worry about you, Kim said, shaking him by his hair and slapping him again. If I have to carry you, it'll be because your legs are broken.
He let go, and Ryder stumbled. Everything hurt. This was worse than the other night, maybe because he went unconscious so fast then.
Walk, kid, Officer Kim said. Think of all the places that don't hurt. I swear to God I won't hesitate to take you apart piece by piece.
Ryder searched the darkness for his brother, but couldn't see him. Couldn't hear him.
Is he still alive? Not my table, kid.
This next kick was more of a shove with the sole of his shoe. Ryder lunged forward and stumbled, catching himself with his hands against the gravel of the road.
All the way to the door, Kim directed. Don't look back.
Ryder did as he was told. He limped against the gravel that ravaged his feet. But he didn't complain, and he tried not to make any moaning sounds. He didn't know what was coming next, but he knew it would be awful. All that hope from before was gone, evaporated. Now there was only pain. His heart hammered so hard in his chest that it felt bruised. His whole body shook. He collapsed again, but scrambled right back to his feet.
Please don't kick me anymore.
As tears streaked down his face, he heard the choking sound of a sob coming from his own throat. But he felt separated from all that. He felt as if he were maybe watching a movie of everything that was happening, a movie so awful and so real that he dreaded seeing the ending. Because he knew what the ending had to be.
Where is Jeffy?
Ryder had talked him into this. Jeff wanted to stay behind, and Ryder thought he was a pussy for it. He played the big brother card, and this is where it ended up. Though he couldn't see them to be sure, He was certain that the soles of his feet were bleeding by the time he got to the front porch. He climbed the two steps and waited, staring at the big padlock that dangled from the even bigger hasp.
"You know, I've been waiting for you to grow a set big enough to try and get away," Officer Kim said as he shoved Ryder out of the way and produced a key from his pocket. "That's why I've been leaving you alone. I can't believe it took you this long."
Ryder refocused his eyes to a spot back down the driveway where he could see Jeff limping along in front of Officer Al. From posture alone, he knew his brother was crying, but he couldn't hear anything. Kim pushed the door open and hurled Ryder again by his hair. He landed in a sprawl on the hard wooden floor. Expecting another kick, the boy scurried on all fours to get out of the way. Officer Al arrived at the door with Jeff, who had a new bruise under his left eye and a bloody nose. He'd stopped crying, though.
"I was even on your side, boys," Al said as he pushed Jeff through the door and closed it behind him. "We fed you, gave you a place to shit and piss, and even gave you time out in the yard."
While Al spoke, Kim pulled the corner of the rug in the middle of the floor to reveal a 3-foot square hatch. "We even warned you that there'd be consequences if you didn't behave." Kim turned a recessed latch and lifted the panel up. It folded itself over flat against the floor via a hinge that Ryder couldn't see.
"Go on," Kim said. "Both of you."
Ryder shared a panicked glance with his brother.
What is it?"
"I think they called it a root cellar 100 years ago," Officer Al said. "But you can call it your new home."
Neither of the boys moved.
"It's going to be damned uncomfortable," Kim said. "But it'll be more uncomfortable with those broken legs we were talking about."
Officer Al moved first, urging Jeff along with a hand between his shoulder blades. Jeff cooperated until they were just a few feet away, and then he pulled back.
"No," he shouted. "Please! No, not down there, please!"
Officer Kim took a step closer to the little brother, and Ryder yelled, "Stop, Officer Kim, stop! I'll do this!" Something passed between the two adults, something that Ryder didn't understand, something they found amusing. Ryder pushed past Kim and took his brother by the shoulders.
"Jeffy, listen to me."
Panic had set Jeff's eyes afire. He was beyond panic, beyond being able to understand.
"Jeffy, come with me. I'm going too. We'll be together. Come on. I'll go down first, and then you can follow."
"Just like you followed him before, Jeffy," Kim mocked. "How'd that work out for you?"
"Don't be an asshole," Officer Al said. That thing between them, whatever it was, turned unfunny. Ryder peered down into the root cellar. It was dark, but there was enough of a wash of light from above to make out a dirt floor maybe 4 feet down.
"Is there a ladder?"
Ryder asked.
"Just jump," Officer Al said. "It's not far."
"What about a light?"
"Get used to the dark," Kim said.
Jeff made a keening sound with his throat. He was desperate with fear. So was Ryder, but he couldn't show his. Ryder went first. He sat on the floor at the edge of the opening, then slid down the rest of the way. With his feet on the dirt, his shoulders were still peeking through. He held out his arms for his brother.
"Come on, Jeff. We can do this."
"I don't want to."
"Neither do I, but we have to."
Officer Al used a coaxing, gentle push to move Jeff closer to the hatch. Ryder held his hands out, and Jeff took them.
"Sit on the edge like I did," Ryder explained. "And then just lean into me."
Still snuffling, eyes still unfocused, Jeff did exactly as he was told. A few seconds later, they were both in the root cellar.
"Watch your head," Kim declared, and he flung the heavy wooden hatch up and over.
Ryder covered Jeff as if from a grenade in the movies, smothering him with his arms and pulling them both down into the dirt. He got a mouthful of it, and he spit out mud. Now the darkness was beyond black. It smelled wet down here, and it was cold. Not freezing cold, but blanket cold. Blankets they didn't have. A wave of sorrow broke over Ryder and overwhelmed him. It welled up from some place deep, and it churned his insides. In the blackness, he found his brother's shoulders, and then his face. He moved in and hugged him close. Ryder's sobs boiled up from a place he'd never visited before, driven by a pure, knife-sharp hopelessness and terror.
"I'm sorry, Jeff," he choked. "I'm so, so sorry."
He only hoped that when they got around to killing them, Kim didn't really start by breaking all of his bones. He hoped he'd die quickly. Abby Turner, the Sallyport guard, threw her hands in the air and gasped.
"God in heaven and sunny Jesus! What the hell is Sid Hoffman doing here at this hour?"
Sid smiled and tapped his temple with his forefinger.
"It's called being crazy," he said. "I couldn't sleep, so I thought I'd come in and relieve Norm Syme. Let him get home in time to cook breakfast for his kids."
Abby buzzed him in.
"I don't like nobody enough to come to work at 4 in the morning.
"It's almost 4:30. Sid joked.
He ran his pocket junk and his jacket through the X-ray machine and walked through the magnetometer. He leaned in closer and winked. "Maybe he'll remember the favor when I want to party at home on New Year's Eve." Abby laughed, a big, throaty guffaw.
"I don't like nobody enough to do that, either."
Murder Mountain was one of the oldest United States penitentiaries in the system. Built in the early 1900s and designed to the same philosophical standards as Sing Sing and Alcatraz, this place was at least as much about punishment as it was penance. Back in the day, long before Sid's time, this was a place of heavy leg irons, years-long isolation, and bread-and-water diets. While incarceration philosophies had changed over the decades, the physical facility had remained more or less the same as it had always been. Because it had been incongruously named a historic landmark, every modernization to the exterior was required to perpetuate the incarceration nightmare theme. The interior of the prison was the same monochrome, white-turned-gray look that had become the standard for penitentiaries over the years. More modern prisons were built around central pods where inmates could gather in a place immediately outside of their cells, but Murder Mountain arranged their cells in tiered blocks. 20 cells on a row, 3 tiers on a block, for a total of 60 inmates per each of the 15 cell blocks that made up the prison. Those were the design specifications. In reality, more than half of the cells that were designed for one prisoner, in fact, held 2. An effort was made, or so Sid had been told by the makers of the rules, to match cellies by category of crimes committed. Nonviolent drug offenders housed together, for example. But those same rulemakers clearly didn't commit a lot of energy to the challenge. The cells were only 6 feet wide by 8 feet long, and that space included 2 bunks, a toilet-slash-sink combination, and a fold-down writing desk. Occupied by 2 grown men, every moment of every day was ripe for a fight, and in a place like Murder Mountain, fights were serious events, all too often fought until one of the combatants was dead. Sid made his way to the command booth. He had to stop and be buzzed through 3 man-traps before he arrived, so there was certainly no surprise for Norman Syme, the officer on duty, when he did. Sid slid his ID into the reader, and Norman buzzed him in. The command booth was a bulletproof steel and Lexan octagon packed with monitor screens and knobs and switches that controlled everything from the lights to the door locks to the air handlers. A countertop ringed the base of the monitors, forming a kind of continuous desk around the whole space. In the center of the octagon, there was enough room for 3 rolling office chairs, a mini-fridge, and a microwave. It wasn't much, but it was the space Sid Hoffman had worked an entire career to command. From this spot, elevated to a level above the 3rd tier of cells, they could see the length of each of the rows of cells that branched out like wheel spokes, but their view was limited by various levels of expanded metal screening and guardrails. Directly below them, similar octagons tracked the individual tiers.
"Morning, Sid," Norman said. "Abby said you were having a hard time sleeping." "That Abby," Sid said with rolled eyes. "She's a talker, isn't she?"
He put down the black backpack that doubled as his briefcase and nudged it under the desk with his toe. He spun one of the chairs around and took a seat.
"You're welcome to go home now, if you'd like."
"Not if it's going to cost me my New Year's Eve at home."
At 28, Norman still looked like a little kid. His hands and feet seemed too big for his body. His auburn hair was perpetually disheveled, and a patch of freckles littered the bridge of his nose and his cheeks.
"I was joking with her," Sid assured. "Jesus, was there anything she didn't repeat? Did she also tell you that I thought you might want to get home in time to fix breakfast for the family?"
Norman smiled and reared back in his chair.
"Did you really say that?"
"I did."
Norman stood and grabbed his own backpack.
"If you make that an order, I'm out of here."
"All right, then, that's an order."
Beaming, Norman swung his hand for a low 5 and headed for the door, where he waited for Sid to buzz him out. When the lock hummed, he hesitated, then turned.
"Oh, are you going to take care of your time card?" Sid finished.
"Yes, I'll take care of it."
"All right, then," Norman said as he pulled the door open. "Feel free to sleepwalk like this any time you want."
As Norman disappeared into the maze of barred and locked passageways, Sid went to work. The regular morning shift would come on at 7, and when they arrived, they would be fresh and attentive and geared up for action, the way that the outgoing night shift would not be. Like everywhere else in the world, the graveyard shift at Murder Mountain was where the staff could get the most rest while doing the least amount of work. For now, Sid was the most senior officer present in the facility, a fact that would change at 7. The graveyard crew wasn't used to seeing a lieutenant among their ranks, and they would be hesitant to question his actions. As he walked out onto the catwalk and then down the stairs to level 1, he wondered how many officers' cell phones were igniting in their pockets. Lieutenant Hoffman was in early and on the loose. What the hell had someone done wrong? Sid was headed for the CMU, the Communications Management Unit, an ugly child of the post-9/11 panic that created prison units specifically for those who were accused or convicted of terrorism. An advanced form of solitary confinement, the CMU was based on the theory that by keeping bad guys from speaking to other bad guys, ongoing conspiracies could be disrupted, and new ones would never form. Originally designed as a storage facility for the prison back in the pre-refrigeration days, Q-Block, as it was now called, was a dank corridor that had been blasted out of the bedrock beneath the prison. Using the fire hose of Homeland Security money, The Federal Bureau of Prisons had employed huge drilling bits to expand the width and height of the cave, and then outfitted it with 20 cells that would be dedicated to housing single occupants. The prisoners would be locked behind solid steel doors for 23 hours a day. The CMU was a soul-stealing place, the ultimate psychological torture, Sid thought. It was so bad, in fact, that his correctional officers had to rotate on no longer than a 3-week schedule in order to keep their sanity. More recently, Q-Block housed more drug kingpins than it did terrorists, though Sid could be talked into believing that folks who ran drug operations were terrorists. God knew they'd directly or indirectly taken at least as many lives as ISIS or the Taliban. A few days ago, with exactly zero advance notice, Sid and his counterparts on the other two shifts were directed to figure out a way to clear out Q-Block to make room for a special inmate. The 17 dudes who were so scary that they needed to be isolated from the world now needed to be moved someplace out among the general population. 17 of 20 cells in Q-Block all needed to be cleared out so that one witness, not even a convicted criminal, could be housed by herself. Herself. A woman. In a man's prison. What could possibly go wrong? Connie Kendall had been placed in a special detention cell within the CMU. There were only two such cells, and they were located on opposite ends of the cell block. Devoid of any furniture and equipped with nothing but a toilet-slash-sink combination, the SDCs had irregular walls and ceilings and floors, and there were no right angles. What appeared to be concrete was actually lead-lined drywall, covered with a heavy layer of rubberized epoxy paint. When the cell door was closed, the interior was nearly perfect, acoustically. Sound did not resonate. The inmate could make noise, of course, but the noise died against the non-reflective surfaces of the walls. Connie Kendall was the only inmate on Q-Block. She could be tortured in those cells, and the sound would die at the door. Only the shift supervisor interacted with special detainees, and then it was only to bring food or to escort them under heavy guard to meetings with prosecutors and lawyers. And there had been more than a few meetings over these past couple of days. As Sid turned the last corner to approach the command booth for Q-Block, Officer Steiner was already on his feet, waiting just on the other side of the bulletproof Lexan. Sid slid his access card, and Steiner buzzed him in. On the screens behind Steiner, Sid could see the images from low-light cameras showing the star inmate asleep in her bunk. "What's up, Sid?" "I need access to Kendall, Connie." "At this hour? What the hell?" "This shit just gets weirder and weirder." Sid was bluffing now. Riffing, really. He needed to gain access to the detainee, and to do that, he had to create a reason. But the reason needed to be one that could not be verified. "Who hauled you in at Zero Dark Zip?" Sid went for serious on this one.
"You know how this works, Joel.
Don't ask me questions I can't answer."
"What exactly do you need to do?"
"Was there something about don't ask questions I can't answer that eluded you?" "I need to get access to Kendall." Steiner scowled and rubbed the back of his neck.
"There's no protocol for this, Sid. You're asking me to break about a dozen rules. Where does your authorization come from?"
"My authorization comes from where it comes from," Sid said. He could hear the bullshit in his own words, and he tried to cover them with an even sterner tone. "Now, count the bars on your collar. You don't have any. I do. That means you're authorization comes from me. Steiner looked as if he'd been slapped.
Jesus, Sid.
Sid pulled back. I'm sorry. It's early. I'm pissed that I have to be here, and I've got to get this thing done. If I could answer your questions, I swear to God I would. You know I'll have to put it in the logbook, Steiner said. No, you don't, Sid countered. This is going to send you into orbit, but my orders are very clear. You are not to enter this meeting in the log, and you are to turn off the video cameras inside Kendall's cell.
Oh, come on, Sid, be reasonable. That's another dozen rules.
Do you think I'm making this shit up? Sid asked. I mean, really? Do you think I'd haul my ass out of bed at this ridiculous hour just to make you break the rules? What, maybe I want your job? I'm a lieutenant, for heaven's sake. I don't want to be a CO again. Steiner was only half sold. Nothing about this Kendall thing has been handled by the book, Sid pressed. This was the part of his plan that he thought could sell the scam. We're not supposed to mix CMU inmates with Gen Pop, but that's what we've done. We're not supposed to do anything that disrupts the rhythm of this place, but we've put it on its ear anyway. This is just another layer of shit that we're going to have to clean up later. As he listened to Sid's words, Joel Steiner became agitated. He nodded aggressively. What the hell do they think they're doing? He asked.
They don't care how all this crap affects us, Sid said. I don't think this is Bureau of Prisons. This is FBI or CIA. Their whole shtick is stirring shit. Why should they care what we have to clean up?
More nodding from Steiner.
So, Sid said, bringing the conversation back on point, I need you to take the cameras offline in Kendall Connie's cell and buzz me in when I get down there.
You're going into the cell by yourself?
I'll have my radio.
That's not safe.
She's a lady lawyer. I've beaten down friggin' monsters. I think I'll be okay.
Steiner clearly didn't want to do this. Sid could see the options to derail the plan steaming through the correctional officer's head. He could also see that he was pulling up blanks.
How long?
Jesus, Joel. As long as it takes, okay? I've got a radio, and I've got orders. Steiner hung his head and shook it to make the point that he was deeply not happy. But he reached across the console and flipped the toggle switch that made Connie Kendall disappear from the monitors.
Audio 2, Sid reminded.
As a matter of course, I don't keep the mics active. Sid glanced at the soundboard and verified that all the bars were at zero.
All right, then. Here we go.
Steiner buzzed him in to Q-Block, and he was on his way. Connie Kendall's left arm might as well have been ablaze. It burned that bad. For over a year, she'd known that the herniated disc between C5 and C6 in her neck was impinging on her spinal cord. The MRI never lied, but the pain came and went and was fairly well controlled through the use of a special pillow that kept her shoulders elevated, plus a generous prescription for gabapentin. The surgery necessary to relieve the pain permanently required the removal of the discs and the insertion of fusion material, all within millimeters of her spinal cord. It was the kind of procedure that was easy to put off. But since her arrest, any pillow at all had been denied, and the powers that be had decided that gabapentin was some kind of gateway narcotic. The effect was non-stop agony when she lay down. There was some relief if she lay on her right side with her knees up and her right arm curled under her head, but it was a posture she could only hold for an hour or two at a time. She doubted that she'd had any 10-minute period of heavy REM sleep since she'd arrived here, wherever here was. The prison administration, is that even what it is called, made sure that she was as unsettled as possible at all times. At any given point, she had no idea what time it was. Still, it seemed awfully early for the lock and her door to be turning. Her neck and arm screamed as she rolled to her right side and then pushed herself up to a sitting position. Her heart hammered and her hands shook. Nothing about what had transpired these past few days came close to being right, but this early morning invasion felt especially wrong. After the last conversation with James Abrenio, after agreeing to the deal she had not yet signed that would ruin her family's future forever, any variation from the schedule felt like an imminent threat. Relief washed over her as the opening door revealed Lieutenant Hoffman.
"Inmate Kendall," he said, "I need to wake you up."
He stepped inside and pulled the heavy door closed behind him.
"I'm awake," Connie said. "What time is it?"
"It's early," Hoffman said. "The exact hour doesn't matter."
"Is something wrong?"
"Are you awake enough to read and comprehend?" The question did nothing to slow her heartbeat.
"I don't understand."
"It's not complicated, Connie." Hoffman looked unnerved, frightened, maybe. "Do you need a moment to splash water on your face? Will that make it easier for you?"
"You seem angry," Connie said. "Have I done—"
"Answer the goddamn question, Connie. Read, yes or no?" She jumped at the outburst.
Yes,
she stammered. "Then here." Hoffman reached into a pocket somewhere beneath his uniform jacket and withdrew a plain No. 9 envelope. He handed it over to her. It was unaddressed.
"What is this?"
Connie withdrew into the unyielding wall. In her mind, the envelope was poisonous, the last thing she wanted to touch. "I don't know," Hoffman said. "And I mean that. I have no idea what it contains, and I don't want to."
He pulled the letter back and stepped closer. "Let me be crystal clear about this, Connie. I don't want to know anything about the contents. Truth be told, I don't think you're going to want me to know. Are we clear about this?" Connie wanted to run, but there was no place to go.
"No, we're not clear. I don't even know what we're talking about."
"Please don't make this any more difficult than it already is," Hoffman said. "Open it, digest it, and give it back to me. Then you're supposed to give me a message to take back." He thrust it out to her. Connie didn't move. Neither did Hoffman. His hand and the letter hovered in space. His fingers trembled. Not a lot, but she could see it. His grim features looked gray around his nose and mouth. She took the letter from him. The sealed adhesive flap had been reinforced by scotch tape with a dollop of wax at the point. No fancy crest or monogram in the seal, though. This one was purely utilitarian. A confirmation that she was the first to breach the envelope.
"I don't suppose you may have a letter opener I can borrow?" she quipped. "Maybe a sharp knife?"
Hoffman attempted a smile, but it wasn't there. It was useless to try to lift the flap. All edges were flush. Instead, she turned the rectangle vertical, squeezing it. She tore the envelope along one of its short sides. She blew into the opening to puff it out, then slid out the trifolded 8.5 by 11 sheet of white paper. She flattened it on her thigh to reveal what might have been a business letter. 10-point Arial font, flush left, block paragraphs.
Dear Connie, you've made promises to people. You have obligations, you have responsibilities, and we have your boys. They were on their way to Fisherman's Cove, Virginia, when we took them. I'm sorry to say that people died. Your boys are safe, though, for now. Do you remember Kim, the Asian with the red spot on his face? Do you remember what he's capable of? He's in charge of your boys, of Ryder and Jeff. No, it's Geoff, isn't it? How very pretentious. I'd send pigs if I could, but that's not very practical. You have to trust me. Believe me, and believe this. If you speak of things you shouldn't, we will take your children apart. We will disassemble them. Yes, they will die, but only days after they first start begging for death. Your husband was not a trailblazer in those areas, Connie. In the overall scheme, he was a lightweight. Kim is the expert. Think about this as you meet with your lawyer and the prosecutors. Whatever you do, we will know. Have a nice day, Connie. Now, flush this letter down the commode and return the envelope to Lieutenant Hoffman with your fingerprint on it. Use dirt or blood for ink, but this will be our assurance that you received our letter. Tell Lieutenant Hoffman to meet me at 10 a.m. tomorrow at the place where he last spoke with Tom. The letter was unsigned, but no signature was necessary. This was the work of Daoud Masayev, and the brilliance of his plan could not have been held in higher relief. Anyone who might intercept this note would naturally, reflexively assume that it came from Armand Cortez. Only she would know the truth, and she was uniquely disinclined to reveal it. Her stomach churned and her hands trembled more violently as she tore the letter up into tiny pieces and floated them into the stainless steel toilet. "These are my instructions," she said as she pressed the flush handle. As the paper swirled and disappeared, she stooped to the floor and rubbed her hands into the grime at the corner and then pressed the tips of four fingers onto the face of the envelope. She stood again and faced Hoffman. "He mentions you by name," she said. She threw the words as verbal rocks, and they made contact with as much force. Hoffman grew paler still as his eyes grew wet and red. "I told you that I don't want to know."
"It says that if I sign a plea agreement, they will kill my children."
Hoffman lunged forward. With a sweeping arc of his left arm, he snatched the envelope from her hand. "Stop!"
"How did they know to mention you personally, Lieutenant Hoffman?" "What have you done? What have you done to me?"
Hoffman stood, frozen in place. He looked as if he wanted to say something, but there was a disconnect between his brain and his tongue.
"You are to take the envelope back to him at 10 o'clock where you met Tom. Does that mean anything to you?"
Hoffman turned on his heel and disappeared out the door. The lock reset with a soft